Well, as we've been hearing all week, there are serious fears about what the Taliban seizure of Afghanistan might mean for the country and for Afghans, women and girls in particular. You might like to read a particularly bitter column by our guest, if you recall, from 2 weeks ago. What an extraordinarily prescient interview he gave us, David Kilcullen, who the counterinsurgency specialist. It's just really quite remarkable to read his material today. He is apologising for being wrong on almost every prediction about Kabul. I simply could not credit the possibility that the US government and the entire international community would just abandon Kabul overnight without a fight, leaving their own evacuation plan in disarray and surrendering both the Afghans and many thousands of their own citizens at the mercy of the Taliban. I was wrong and I apologise. That piece by David Kilcullen in the Weekend Australian. It's quite something. I don't think I've seen anything quite like it. So let's just further develop our understanding of who the Taliban 2.0 is, as it's been put. What could we learn that might help us understand the unfolding situation better, as we heard from Q&A on Thursday night, just to stay engaged? Carter Malkasian is the author of The American War in Afghanistan, A History. He served as a civilian advisor in Iraq and Afghanistan and was the senior advisor to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff from 2015 to 2019, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Geraldine. It's great to be here.
It's still, I would like you to disabuse me of any notions that I bring that you've come to wonder about. But it would seem that the Taliban is still fundamentally an Islamist militant movement. Do they seem to have been evolving in terms of how, certainly in terms of how they operate strategically, but are they evolving politically? Yes, we've just heard on our previous sister program, they've been much better at propaganda, but I wonder what your assessment is as to whether they could morph into a political organization.
Well, I think I'd say right now that they are a political organization. And in fact, they're the most effective political organization in Afghanistan, and they've been that for some time. Now, that doesn't mean that they're a moderate organization. And I think they are portraying themselves as more moderate, and they've made a number of announcements that you've heard. But at the same time, I think they are deeply committed to their interpretation of Islamic law. They're deeply connected to the way they committed to the way they've ruled, at least in essence, in the past. So I think we're going to see some similarities there, even if like the open beatings, the stoning of women, the public executions, even if we see less of that.
How big is the Taliban today? Do we know?
I don't think we really know. In the past, the estimate, and what I mean in the past, like 2015 to 2018 or so, the guesses were like between 60 and 80,000. Mm. I think what we've seen over the past week, and even before, that means they're probably well over 100,000. And that's partly because they generated a lot of support as they were gaining more and more ground, more and more people were coming to work with them. More ground means more recruits. And I think lots of Afghans and Pashtuns who had been refugees or in Madras in Pakistan probably came over to join them as well for this giant offensive that they've had. So I'd say at this point their militant numbers are probably well over 100,000.
And who's who in the Taliban? Can you tell us more about that? I mean, are there different factions? Does one faction want to become more political or one more theocratic and one more clearly militant? How would you read it?
Well, one thing the Taliban always say to us is when you attempt to talk about moderate or people with different views or people with more militant views, I always say, no, there's only one Taliban. And we don't have factions like that. Now, that's a bit of a cover-up. But I would want to stress that the Taliban are a fairly cohesive organization, maybe not like a U.S. military organization or an Australian military organization, but they do a good job of not having too many frictures and feuds. But you have the main Taliban group that started with the name the Taliban, that's kind of more originating in the south of Afghanistan, and then you have another major group, the Haqqani Network, which is more in the eastern part of Afghanistan, known as Loya Paktia, and then the adjoining part of Pakistan. And the Haqqani group is part of the Taliban. They're listens to the Taliban leader, obeys him, but they are their own separate organization, almost like the special forces are kind of separate within the larger structure of a military. And the Taliban today are led by Mully Haybatullah. And he's been in charge since 2016. He's a religious scholar and was formerly the high judge of their court. But we haven't seen a lot of him, and we haven't heard a lot of him from him in the past two months or so. So it does kind of raise the question of, is he really around, or like Mullah Omar?
He was dead for two years before people knew.
exactly.
Okay, so... there isn't really a new generation of leaders coming through. These are predominantly, am I right, the figures who've been there more or less since the 90s or since certainly the early 2000s?
No, it's definitely a mix. So like Mully Haybatullah himself was not a senior leader in the 90s. He became more senior in like 2007, 2008 or so. And then people like Sirajuddin Haqqani, who's the head of the Haqqani network, he took over for his father, Jalaluddin Haqqani. And so he really came into power again in the late aughts. 2010, 2011 kind of time frame. So he's a bit younger. And then there's people like Mullah Yaqub, the son of Mullah Omar, who he really didn't appear on the scene until his father died in 2015. So you have a mix of people. And you also can't underrate, like, the Taliban have had a lot of battlefield losses. So a lot of younger commanders have come up over time in the course of that attrition. I think that's a reasonable mix. And then the one person who is from the older time is Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar, who we've seen on TV a great deal. He's the one shaking the hand of Khalilzad.
Yes.
So he joined the movement right after its founding. He was the actual deputy of the whole movement from 2002 up until his detention in 2010. And he was kind of like the chief executive officer. He's a very respected figure.
Have they all got blood on their hands? In that I noticed that Ben Jensen and another very American analyst writing during the week in the Atlantic Council talked about the incredible, trying to look back at how it all happened like this, the incredible covert assassination campaign that has been underway for the last 2 years to target civil society leaders, key military personnel, particularly pilots. Now, I just wonder whether, you know, they've all been fighters and so they've all got that behind them, which does shape the way I would think they can adapt to something like a peacetime life.
Well, that's a good question, and it's kind of, you know, what constitutes blood on their hands? I know what their immediate reaction would be if I was to ask them this. They'd say, "What are you talking about? You have drone strikes, and you hit and you strike people with aircraft, and you've raided people's homes." Now, I don't want to make equivalent on us and them, but I think you could also look at it in terms of like suicide bombing. Taliban trains people to go blow themselves up, you know, ostensibly to kill to hit a military target or a government target, but almost always civilians are killed in the process. And how much of the organization has been in favor of that? Well, Sirajuddin Haqqani, the main organizer of that, Mully Haybatullah blessed it with a fatwa when he was in charge of the high court. So there, again, it depends on how we define it. But in terms of those kind of acts, lots of the Taliban have been involved in that in one way or another. And will that shape how they run the country? You know, probably, yes, it will. And the other thing that will shape them is that it's going to be hard for them to resist reprisals. Now, on the same token, it was hard for the government to resist reprisals when they were in charge, and especially in like 2002 to 2005. So this cycle is probably going to continue. It's a cycle of civil wars. It's what happens. So we're probably going to see some tragedy there.
What about Sunni and Shia, for instance? Is that important to consider here or not?
Not as important as in Iraq. It's defining in Iraq. Here in Afghanistan, there is a Shia population. The main Shia population are Hazaras, which have tended to live in the center of the country, but also in Mazar-e-Sharif and Kabul. and a few other places. And the Hazaras are not well treated, well, not just by the Taliban, but by other Pashtuns and other elements of the population, because they have more Asian features. And so the Taliban have regularly kind of had conflict with them and haven't treated them well, and I would suspect that will also continue.
What would you care to predict about how they might govern then, which is to do with managing money? This is a very important thing. All people in government have to work that out. Just the notion that they, especially in Kabul, they've got a population that has been is very secularized, as I understand it. I mean, yeah, do you think there will be people emerge who do enjoy the prestige of being taken seriously as governors or not?
Well, right now they want the prestige as the ruling power of the country. They want the prestige as a legitimate state, as legitimate rulers. They want the international community to look at them like that, and they want to be able to move about the international stage without being sanctioned. So they do desire that greatly, and they also know that the Afghan people weren't terribly pleased with how they administered the country in the 1990s. So they want to deliver goods and services. They want to make sure that NGOs and other humanitarian assistance is going on. They recognize that without international community funding, it's going to be more difficult for them to provide goods and services. So they want those things. But they also have other interests that they're after that they may not be willing to bend in order to get those things. And that's going to be one of the challenges that faces them. And I guess my prediction would be that in the end, they may try hard, but it's going to be hard for them to get international funding of a large scale.
So if you were advising, I mean, is it worth attempting to pick out people who might want to be seen as people who can stride the world stage in some form, or is this a useless endeavour? That's what I'm trying to discern. Maybe you don't know the answer to that either.
The question that we want to ask ourselves is, what are our fundamental interests at this point in Afghanistan? And how much investment do we want to make into it? Is it worth it for us to be investing and spending a lot of time here? Or is this just going to be more frustration, more the Taliban trying to get things from us and not giving much in return? And them, you know, telling us one thing yet doing something else. I mean, we all left Afghanistan because of the feeling that the country actually isn't that inherent to our interests, only that the terrorism aspect is. Well, if the country isn't that inherent to our interests, how much of our wealth do we want to be spending there?
Look, we're going to try to look at this further next week, although there's been so much coverage of just, you know, who lost Afghanistan. I mean, it is quite amazing. It's been a terrible really, and God knows it's so much more demanding for people there. But, you know, what's your answer when you're asked that question? When did it all start to go wrong in terms of a sense that it could be made into a different culture?
Well, it probably started to go wrong very early. And, you know, what you say reminds me directly of what my doctoral supervisor told me some 20 years ago. And that's Robert J. O'Neill, who's an Australian.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was the intelligence officer for the 5th Royal Australian Regiment in Vietnam, so he had seen combat directly. And he said that if you aren't able to address the major problems early, it will be too late. That democracies will have too much trouble continuing these wars for a long period. If one's not able to act early, then the opportunity will be lost. And I think there's something to that.
Okay, we might come back to you later. Look, thank you very much indeed at the end of a pretty grim week for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on, and have a good weekend.
Carter Malkasian is the author of The American War in Afghanistan, A History. He was senior advisor to the chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff from 2015 to 2019. And I might add, part of that amazing piece by David Kilcullen, very angry that the Afghan army has been blamed. They have been carrying the main burden, combat burden of the war since late 2014, losing close to 70,000 casualties in that time against a few dozen on the coalition's part. The Afghans have been fighting desperately to survive.